sensation inside. On the third exhale, a blue firefly popped out and flew away. Holden became aware of a faint scent of acetate in the air.
"We need to talk," said a familiar voice in the darkness.
Holden's throat went tight. His heart began to pound. He pulled a pillow over his face and suppressed an urge to scream, as much from frustration and rage as the old familiar fear that tightened in his chest.
"So, there was this rookie," Miller started. "Good kid. You'd have hated him."
"I can't take this shit," Holden said, yanking the pillow away from his face and throwing it in the direction of Miller's voice. He slapped the panel by the bed, and the room's lights came on. Miller was standing by the door, the pillow behind him, wearing the same rumpled gray suit and pork pie hat, fidgeting like he had a rash.
"He never really learned to clear a room, you know," Miller continued. His lips were black. "Corners and doorways," I tried to tell him. "It's always corners and doorways."
Holden reached for the comm panel to call Naomi, then stopped. He wanted her to be there, to make the ghost vanish the way it always had before. And he was also afraid that this time it wouldn't.
"Listen, you've got to clear the room," Miller said, his face twisted with confusion and intensity, like a drugged man trying to remember something important. "If you don't clear the room eats you."
"What do you want from me?" Holden said. "Why are you making me go out there?" A thick exasperation twisted Miller's expression.
"What the hell are you hearing me say? You see a room full of bones, only thing you know is something got killed. You're the predator, right up until you're prey."
He stopped, staring at Holden, waiting for an answer. When Holden didn't respond, Miller moved a step closer to the bed. Something on his face made Holden think of the times he'd watched the cop shoot people. He opened a cabinet by the bed and took out his sidearm.
"Don't get any closer,"
Holden said, not pointing the gun at Miller yet.
"But be honest. If I shot you, would you even die?"
Miller laughed. His expression became almost human.
"Depends."
The door opened, and Miller blinked out. Naomi came in wearing a robe and carrying a bulb of water.
"You awake?"
Holden nodded, then opened the cabinet and put the gun away. His expression must have told Naomi everything.
"Are you all right?"
"Yeah.
He vanished when you opened the door."
"You look terrified," Naomi said, putting her water down and sliding under the covers next to him.
"He's scarier now. Before, I thought, I don't know what I thought. But ever since he knew about the gate, I keep trying to figure out what he really means. It was easier when I could think it was some kind of static, that it didn't mean anything."
Naomi curled up against his side, putting her arms around him. He felt his muscles relaxing.
"We can't let Monica and her crew ever know about this," he said.
Naomi's smile was half sorrow.
"What?
James Holden not telling everyone everything?" she said.
"This is different."
"I know."
"What did he say?" Naomi asked. "Did it make sense?"
"No, but it was all about death. Everything he says is about death."
Over the course of the following weeks, the ship fell into a routine that, while not comfortable, was at least collegial. Holden spent time with the documentary crew being filmed, showing them the ship, answering questions. What was his childhood like? Loving and complex and bittersweet. Had he really saved Earth by talking the half-aware girl who'd been the protomolecule's seed crystal into rerouting to Venus?
No. Mostly that had just worked out well.
Did he have any regrets?
He smiled and took it and pretended he wasn't holding anything back. That the only thing leading him out to the ring was his contract with them. That he hadn't been chosen by the protomolecule for something else that he hadn't yet begun to understand.
Sometimes, Monica turned to the others, but Alex and Naomi kept their answers friendly, polite, and shallow. Amos laced his responses with cheerful and explicit profanity until it was almost impossible to edit into something for a civilized audience. Cohen turned out to be more than a sound engineer. The dark glasses he wore were a sonar feedback system that allowed him to create a three-dimensional model of any space he occupied. When Amos asked why he didn't have prosthetics instead, Cohen had told him that the accident that claimed his eyes also burned the optic nerves away. The attempted nerve regrowth therapy had failed and almost killed him with an out-of-control brain tumor. But the interface that allowed his brain to translate sonar data into a working 3D landscape also made him an extraordinary visual effects modeler. While Monica spun a narrative of Holden's life following the destruction of his ship, the Canterbury, Cohen created beautiful visual renderings of the scenes. At one point, he showed the crew a short clip of Holden speaking, describing the escape from Eros after the initial protomolecule infection, all while he appeared to be moving down perfectly rendered Erosian corridors filled with bodies. Part of Holden had almost come to enjoy the interviews, but he could only watch the Eros graphics for a few seconds before he asked Cohen to turn it off. He'd been sure that seeing it would somehow invoke Miller, but it hadn't. Holden didn't like the memories that came with their story. The documentary crew made accommodations, not forcing him further than he was willing to go. Their being nice about it somehow only made him feel worse. A week out from the ring, they caught up to the behemoth. Monica was sitting on the ops deck with the crew when the massive OPA ship finally got close enough for the Rossi's telescopes to get a good view of her. Holden had allowed the restrictions on where the documentary crew were permitted to just sort of fade away. They were doing a slow pan of the behemoth's hull when Alex whistled and pointed at a protrusion on the side.
"Damn, boss. The Mormons are better armed than I remember. That's a railgun turret right there. And I'd bet a week's desserts those things are torpedo tubes."
"I liked her better when she was a generation ship," Holden replied.
He called up combat ops and told the Rosinante to classify the new hull as the Behemoth-class Dreadnought and add all the hardpoints and weapons to her threat profile.
"That's the kind of stealing only governments can get away with," Amos said. "I guess the OPA is a real thing now."
"Yeah,"
Alex replied with a laugh.
"Mars is making a similar claim against us," Holden said.
"And if we'd been the ones to blow up their battleship before we flew off in this boat, they'd have an argument to make," Amos said.
"Last I checked, that was the bad guys, though."
Naomi didn't chime in. She was working at something on the comm panel. Holden could tell it was a complex problem because she was quietly humming to herself.
"You've been on the Nauvoo before, right?" Monica asked.
"No," Holden said. The Rosinante began rapidly throwing data onto his screen. The ship's calculations of the behemoth's actual combat strength.
"They were still working on it the first time I was on Tycho Station. By the time I started working for Fred Johnson, they'd already shot the Nauvoo at Eros, and she was on her way out of the solar system. I did get to walk through the ship they sent to catch her once."
The Rosinante was displaying puzzling projections at him. The ship seemed to think that the behemoth didn't have the structural strength to support the number and size of weapon hardpoint she currently sported. In fact, she seemed to think that if the OPA battleship ever actually fired two of its six capital ship-class railguns at the same time, there was a 34% chance the hull would rip apart. Just to have something to do,
Holden told DeRossi to create a tactical package for fighting the behemoth and send it to Alex and Naomi. Probably they'd never need it. "You didn't like working for the OPA?" Monica asked. She had the little smile she got when she asked a question she already knew the answer to. Holden suspected the documentarian was also a terrible poker player, but so far he hadn't been able to get her into a game. "It was a mixed bag," he said, forcing himself to smile, to be the James Holden that Monica wanted and expected. To sacrifice himself to her attention, so she'd leave the others be. "Jim," Naomi said, finally looking up from her panel. "You know that memory leak in comms that I've been hunting for a month? It's getting worse. It's driving me nuts."
"How bad?" Alex asked.
"Fluctuating between 0.0021 and 0.033%, she said. "I'm having to flush and reboot every couple of days now." Amos laughed.
"Do we care about that? Because I'll raise you a power leak in the head that's almost a whole percent."
Naomi turned to look at him with a frown. "You didn't tell me?"
"I'll bet you a month's pay it's a worn lead to the lights. I'll yank the fucker out when I get a chance."
"Do those things happen a lot?" Monica asked.
"Hell no," Alex replied before Holden could. "The Rossi is solid."
"Yeah,"
Amos chimed in.
"She's so well put together, we got to obsess over bullshit like crusty memory bubbles and shitty light bulbs just to have something to do."
The smile he aimed at Monica was indistinguishable from the real thing. "So you didn't really answer my question about the OPA, Monica said, swiveling her chair to face Holden. She pointed at the threat map the Rossi had created of the behemoth. The weapon hardpoints like angry blisters dotting her skin. "Everything okay between you?"
"Yeah.
Everyone's still friends," Holden said. "Nothing to worry about." A proximity light flashed as the behemoth bounced a ranging laser off the Rossi's hull. She returned the favor. Not targeting lasers, just two ships making sure they weren't in any danger of getting too close. "Nothing to worry about."
"Yeah, right."
Chapter 11. Melba. Stani stood just behind Melba's left shoulder, looking at the display. His palm rubbed against the slick fabric of his work trousers like he was trying to soothe a cramped quadriceps. Melba had learned to read it as a sign the man was nervous. The narrow architecture of the Cerisier put him so close to her that she could feel the subtle warmth of his body against the back of her neck. In any other context, being this close to a man would have meant they were sharing an intimate moment. Here, it meant nothing. She didn't even find it annoying.
"Mira," Stani said, flapping his hand. "La, right there."
The monitor was old. A constant green pixel burning in the lower left corner where some steady glitch had been irreparable and not worth replacing. The definition was still better than a hand terminal. To the untrained eye, the power demand profile for the UNN Thomas Prince could have been the readout of an EEG or a seismological reading or the visual representation of a Bhangra recording. But over the course of weeks, months now, Melba's eye wasn't untrained. "I see it," she said, putting her finger on the spike. "And we can't tell where it came from?"
"Fucks me," Stani said, rubbing his thigh. "I'm seeing it, but I don't know what I'm looking at."
Melba ran her tongue against the back of her teeth, concentrating, trying to remember what the tutorials had shown about tracking power spikes. In an odd way, her inexperience had shifted into an asset for the team. Stani and Ren, Bob and Soledad, all had more hands-on experience than she did, but she'd only just learned the basics. Sometimes she would know some simple thing that all of them had known once, and only she hadn't forgotten. Her analysis was slower, but it didn't skip steps because she didn't know which steps could be skipped.
Did it start at the deceleration flip? She asked.
Stani grunted like a man struck by a sudden pain.
They hit null G and one of the regulators reset, he said. Least it's nothing serious. Embarrassing to blow up all their preachers, Isa. We'll need to get back over there and check them, though.
Melba nodded and made a mental note to read through what that process required. All she'd known was the truism repeated in three of her tutorials that when a ship cut thrust halfway through a journey, flipped, and began accelerating in the opposite direction, it was time for a special care.
I'll put it on the rotation, she said, and pulled up her team's schedule.
There was a slot in 10 days when there would be enough time to revisit the big ship. She blocked out the time, marked it, and posted it to the full group. All of it felt easy and natural, like the sort of thing she had been doing her whole life, which, in a sense, she had. The flotilla was coming to the last leg of its journey. They had passed the orbit of Uranus weeks ago, and the sun was a bright star in an overwhelming abyss of night sky. All the plumes of fire were pointed toward the ring now, bleeding off their velocity with every passing minute. Even though it was the standard pattern for Epstein Drive ships, Melba couldn't quite shake the feeling that they were all trying to flee from their destination and being pulled in against their will. Unless they were discussing work, the only conversation in the mess hall, on the exercise machines, on the shuttles to and from the ships they maintained, was about the ring. The Martian science ships and their escort were already there, peering through the void. There had been no official reports given, so instead, rumors sprang up like weeds. Every beam of light that passed through the ring and hit something bounced back, just like in normal space. But a few troubling constants varied as you got close to it. The microwave background from inside the ring was older than the Big Bang. People said if you listened carefully to the static from the other side of the ring, you could hear the voices of the dead of Eros, or of the damned. Melba heard the dread in other people's voices, saw Soledad crossing herself when she thought no one was looking, felt the oppressive weight of the object. She understood their growing fear, not because she felt it herself, but because her own private crisis point was coming. The OPA's monstrous battleship was on course to arrive soon, almost at the same time as the Earth flotilla. It wasn't a matter of days yet, but it would be soon. The Rosinante had already passed the slower behemoth. She and Holden were rising up out of the sun's domain, and soon their paths would converge. Then there would be the attack, and the public humiliation of James Holden, and with it, his death. And after that, it was strange to think of an afterward. The more she imagined it, the more she could see herself relaxing back into Melba's life. There was no reason not to. Clarissa Mao had nothing, commanded nothing, was nothing. Melba Co. had work, at least. A history. It was a pretty thought, made prettier by being impossible. She would go home, become Clarissa again, and do whatever else she could to restore her family's name. Honor required it. If she'd stayed, it would have meant being like Julie. Growing up, Clarissa had admired and resented her older sister. Julie, the pretty one, the smart one, the champion yacht racer. Julie who could make father laugh. Julie who could do no wrong. Peter was younger than Clarissa, and so would always be less. The twins, Michael and Anthea, had always been a world unto themselves, sharing jokes and comments that only they understood, and so seemed at times more like long-term guests of the family than part of it. Julie was the oldest, the one Clarissa longed to be, the one to beat. Clarissa hadn't been the only one to see Julie that way. Their mother felt it too. It was the thing that made Clarissa and her mother most alike. And then something happened. Julie had walked away from them all, cut her hair, dropped out of school, and disappeared up into the darkness. She remembered her father hearing the news over dinner. They'd been having kaju murg kari in the informal dining room that overlooked the park. She'd just come back from her riding lesson and still smelled a little of horse. Peter had been talking about mathematics again, boring everyone, when her mother looked up from her plate with a smile and announced that Julie had written a letter to say she'd quit the family. Clarissa's mouth had dropped open. It was like saying that the son had decided to become a politician, or that four had decided to be eight. It wasn't quite incomprehensible, but it lived on the edge. Her father had laughed. He'd said it was a phase. Julie'd gone to live like the common people and sow a few wild oats, and once she'd had her fill, she'd come home. But she'd seen in his eyes that he didn't believe it. His perfect girl was gone. She'd rejected not only him, but the family, their name. Forever after, cashews and curry had tasted like victory. And so Melba would have to be folded up when she was done here, put back in a box and buried or burned. Clarissa could go live with one of her siblings. Peter had his own ship now. She could work on it as an electrochemical engineer, she thought with a smile. Or, in the worst case, stay with Mother. If she told them what she'd done, how she'd saved the family name, then Clarissa could start to rebuild the company, remake their empire in her own name, possibly even free her father from imprisonment and exile. The thought left her feeling both hopeful and tired. A loud clang and the distant sound of laughter brought her back to herself. She reviewed the maintenance schedule for the next 10-day cycle, maintenance on the electrical systems of three of the minor warships, and a physical inventory of the electrical cards, marked the ship's time, and shut down her terminal. The mess hall was half full when she got there, members of a half a dozen other teams eating together and talking and watching the news feeds about the ring, about themselves going to meet it. Soledad was sitting by herself, gaze fixed on her hand terminal, while she ate a green-brown paste that looked like feces but smelled like the finest cooked beef in the world. Melba told herself to think of it as pâté, and then it wasn't so bad. Melba got herself a plate and a bulb of lemon water and slid in across from Soledad. The other woman's eyes flicked up with a small but genuine smile. "Hoi, boss," she said. "How's it go?" "Everything's copacetic," Melba smiled. She smiled more than Clarissa did. That was an interesting thought. "What did I miss?" "Report from Mars. Data this time." "The ship that went through?" "Not on the drift." "Really?" Melba said. After they'd picked up the faint transmission from the little cobbled-together ship that had started all this, the assumption had been that it had been crippled by something that lived on the other side of the ring, that it was floating free. "It's under power?" "Maybe," Soledad said. "Data shows it's moving, and a lot slower than it went in." "And the probes they sent in?" "One of them got grabbed too. Normal burn, and then boom, stopped. The signal's all fucked up, but it looks like the same course that the ship's on. Like they're being taken to the same place, or something." "Weird," Melba said. "But I guess weird is kind of what we expect after Eros." "My dad was on Eros," Soledad said, and Melba felt a strange tightening in her throat. "He worked one of the casinos. Security to make sure no one hacked the games, right? Been there 15 years. Said he was going to retire there.
get a little hole up where he didn't weigh so much and just live off his retirement.
I'm sorry.
Soledad shrugged.
Everyone dies, she said gruffly,
then wiped the back of her hand against her eyes and turned back to the screen.
My sister was there, Melba said.
It was truth, and more than truth.
My sister was one of the first ones it took.
Shit, Soledad said, looking up at her now, terminal forgotten.
Yeah.
The two were quiet for a long moment. At another table, a belter man, no more than 20, barked his knees against the edge of the table and started cursing squat little earth designers to the amusement of his friends.
You think they're still there?
Soledad said softly, nodding at her terminal.
There were those voices. The transmissions that came off Eros. You know, after? It was people, right?
They're dead, Melba said. Everyone on Eros died.
Changed, anyway, Soledad said.
Some guy said it took the patterns off them, right?
Their bodies, their brains.
I think about maybe they never really died. Just got remade, you know? What if their brains never stopped working and just got...
She shrugged, looking for a word, but Melba knew what she meant.
Change, even profound change, wasn't the same as death. She was proof enough of that.
Does it matter?
What if their souls never got loose? Soledad said, with real pain in her voice. What if it caught them all? Right? Your sister? My dad? What if they aren't dead? And rings got all their souls still?
There are no souls, Melba thought with a touch of pity.
We are bags of meat with a little electricity running through them. No ghosts, no spirits, no souls. The only thing that survives is the story people tell about you. The only thing that matters is your name. It was the kind of thing Clarissa would think. The kind of thing her father would have said. She didn't say it aloud.
Maybe that's why Earth's bringing all those priests, Soledad said, and took a scoop of her food.
To put them all to rest.
Someone should. Melba agreed, and then she turned to her meal.
Her hand terminal chimed, Ren requesting a private conversation. Melba frowned and accepted the connection.
What's up? She said.
His voice, when it came, was strained.
I got something I was wondering if you could look at.
An anomaly.
On my way, Melba said.
She dropped the connection and downed her remaining meat paste in two huge swallows, then dropped the plate into the recycler on her way out. Ren was at a workstation in one of the storage bays. It was one of the new spaces he could work in that had a ceiling high enough that he wouldn't have to hunch. Around him, blue plastic crates stood fixed to the floor or one another with powerful electromagnets. Her footsteps were the only sound.
What have you got? She asked.
He stood back and nodded at the monitor.
Air filter data from the Sung-un, he said.
Her blood went cold.
Why? She said too sharply, too quickly.
It's catching a lot of outliers, raised a flag. I'm looking at the profile and it's all high-energy ganga, nitroethines, Isa.
She hadn't thought of this.
She'd known that the ships did passive gas monitoring, but it had never occurred to her that stray molecules of her explosive would get caught in the filters, or that anyone would check.
Ren took her silence as confusion.
Built a profile, he said. 90% fit with a moldable explosive.
So, they've got explosives on board, Melba said.
It's a warship. Explosives is what they do, right?
Despair and embarrassment warred in her chest. She'd screwed up.
She just wanted Ren to be quiet, to not say the things he was saying, that he was going to say. "This is more like what they'd use for mining and excavation," he said. "You inspected that deck. You remember seeing anything funny? Might have been hard to see. This stuff's putty until it hits air." "You think it's a bomb?" she said. Ren shrugged.
"Inners hauling full load of geke? A guy tried to light himself on fire? Hunger strike lady? The one Koyo did that thing with a camera?"
"That wasn't political," she said. "He's a performance artist."
"All I mean, we put together a lot of different kinds of people, think a lot of different kinds of things. Doesn't bring out the best in people. I was a kid. I watched Mielturn end a marriage over whether the Mahdi was going to be a belter. And everybody know everybody back down the well's watching. That kind of attention changes people, and it don't make them better. Maybe someone's planning to make a statement, Sino."
"Did you alert their security?" she asked.
"Check with you first. But something like this, Shigataganai, we got to."
"I have to kill him," she thought, like someone whispering in her ear. She saw how to do it. Get him to look at his screen, hunch over it just a little, enough to bare the back of his neck. Then she would press her tongue against the roof of her mouth, the rough of the taste buds tickling her palate a little, and the strength would come. She'd break him here, and then take him back to her quarters. She could clear out her locker, fit him in, and there was packing sealant that would keep the smell of the body from getting out. She'd file a report, say he was missing. She could act as confused as anyone. By the time she gave up the room and they found him, Melba would already be gone. Even if they worked out that she'd also planted the bomb, they'd just assume she was one of Holden's agents. Ren was looking at her, his brown eyes mild, his carrot-orange hair back in a wiry ponytail that left the skin of his neck exposed. She thought of him explaining about the brownout buffers, the gentleness in his expression, the kindness. "I'm sorry," she thought. "This isn't my fault. I have to." "Let's check the data again," she said, angling her body toward the monitor. "Show me where the anomalies are." He nodded, turning with her. Like everything on the Cerisier, the controls were built for someone a little shorter than Ren. He had to bend a little to reach them. A thickness rose up at the back of her neck, filled her throat. Dread felt like drowning. Ren's ponytail shifted, pulled to the side. There was a mole, brown and ovoid, just where his spine met his skull, like a target. "So I'm looking on this report here," he said, tapping the screen. Melba pressed her tongue against the roof of her mouth. "What about Soledad?" She'd been there when Ren called her. She knew Melba had gone to see him. She might have to kill her, too. Where would she put that body? There would have to be an accident, something plausible. She couldn't let them stop her. She was so close. "It's not going up, though," he said. "Steady levels." She circled her tongue counterclockwise once, then paused. She felt lightheaded, short of breath. One of the artificial glands leaking out, maybe, in preparation for the flood. Ren was speaking, but she couldn't hear him. The sounds of her own breath and the blood in her ears was too loud. "I have to kill him." Her fingers were jittering. Her heart raced. He turned to her, blew a breath out his nostrils. He wasn't a person. He was just a sack of meat with a little electricity. She could do this. For her father. For her family. It needed to be done. When Ren spoke, his voice seemed to come from a distance. "Was denkst du? You want to make the call, you want me to?" Her mind moved too quickly and too slowly. He was asking if they should alert the Sung-un about the bomb. That was what he meant.
Ren, she said. Her voice sounded small, querulous. It was the voice of someone much younger than she was, someone who was very frightened or very sad. Concern bloomed in his expression, drew his brows together.
Hey, you all right, boss?
She touched the screen with the tip of her finger.
Look again, she said softly. Look close.
He turned, bending toward the data as if there were something there to discover. She looked at his bent neck, like she might have looked at a statue in a museum. An object, nothing more. She circled her tongue against the roof of her mouth twice, and calm descended on her. His neck popped when it broke, the cartilaginous discs ripping free, the bundle of nerves and connective tissue that his life had run through coming apart. She kept striking the base of his skull until she felt the bone give way beneath her palm, and then it was time to move the body, quickly, before anyone walked in on them, before the crash came. Fortunately, there was only a little blood.
Chapter 12. Anna. 2 hours into an interfaith prayer meeting, and for the very first time in her life, Anna was tired of prayer. She'd always found a deep comfort in praying, a profound sense of connection to something infinitely larger than herself. Her atheist friends called it awe in the face of an infinite cosmos. She called it God. That they might be talking about the same thing didn't bother her at all. It was possible she was hurling her prayers at a cold and unfeeling universe that didn't hear them, but that wasn't how it felt. Science had given mankind many gifts, and she valued it. But the one important thing it had taken away was the value of subjective, personal experience. That had been replaced with the idea that only measurable and testable concepts had value. But humans didn't work that way, and Anna suspected the universe didn't either. In God's image, after all, being a tenet of her faith. At first, the meeting had been pleasant. Father Michel had a lovely, deep voice that had mellowed with age like fine wine. His lengthy and heartfelt prayer for God's guidance to be upon those who would study the ring had sent shivers down her spine. He was followed by an elder of the Church of Humanity Ascendant, who led the group through several meditations and breathing exercises that left Anna feeling energized and refreshed. She made a note in her hand terminal to download a copy of their book on meditation and give it a read. Not all of the faiths and traditions represented on board took a turn, of course. The imam would not pray in front of non-Muslims, though he did give a short speech in Arabic that someone translated for her through her earbud. When he ended with Allahu Akbar, several people in the audience repeated it back. Anna was one of them. Why not? It seemed polite, and it was a sentiment she agreed with. But after 2 hours, even the most heartfelt and poetic of the prayers had begun to wear on her. She began counting the little plastic domes that hid fire suppression turrets. She'd gotten good at spotting them since the attempted suicide at the first party. She found her mind wandering off to think about the message she'd send to Nono later. The chair she sat in had a very faint vibration that she could almost hear if she remained very still. It must have been the ship's massive drive, and as Anna listened for it, it began to develop a rhythmic pulse. The pulse turned into music, and she began humming under her breath. She stopped when an Episcopalian in the seat next to her pointedly cleared his throat. Hank Cortez was, of course, scheduled to go last. In the weeks and months Anna had been on the Prince, it had become apparent that while no one was officially in charge of the interfaith portion of the Ring expedition,
Dr. Hank was treated as a sort of first among equals. Anna suspected this was because of his close ties to the Secretary General, who'd made the whole mission possible. He also seemed to be on a first-name basis with many of the important artists, politicians, and economic consultants in the civilian contingent of the group. It didn't really bother her. No matter how egalitarian a group might start out, someone always wound up taking a leadership role. Better Dr. Hank than herself. When the Neo-Wiccan priestess, currently at the podium, finally finished her rites, Dr. Hank was nowhere to be seen. Anna felt a little surge of hope that the prayer service would end early. But no. Dr. Hank made his entrance into the auditorium, trailed by a camera crew, and bulled his way up to the podium like an actor taking the stage. He flashed his gleaming smile across the audience, making sure to end with a section the camera people had set up in. "Brothers and sisters," he said, "let us bow our heads and offer thanks to the Almighty and seek his counsel and guidance as we draw ever closer to the end of this historic journey." He managed to rattle on that way for another 20 minutes. Anna started humming again. After, Anna met Tilly for lunch at the officers' mess that had been set aside for civilian use. Anna wasn't exactly sure how she'd wound up being Tilly's best and only friend on the trip, but the woman had latched onto her after their first meeting and burrowed in like a tick. No, that wasn't really fair. Even though the only thing she and Tilly had in common was their carbon base, it wasn't like Anna had a lot of friends on the ship either. And while Tilly could appear flighty and exasperating, Anna had gradually seen through the mask to the deeply lonely woman underneath. Her husband's obscene contributions to the Secretary General's re-election campaign had bought her way onto the flight as a civilian consultant. She had no purpose on the mission other than to be seen, an extended reminder of her husband's enormous wealth and power. That she had nothing else to offer the group only made the real point clearer. She knew it. And everyone else knew it too. Most of the other civilians on the flight treated her with barely concealed contempt. While they waited for their food to arrive, Tilly popped a lozenge in her mouth and chewed it. The faint smell of nicotine and mint filled the air. No smoking on military ships, of course. "How'd your thing go?" Tilly asked, playing with her silver inlaid lozenge box and looking around the room. She was wearing a pants and blouse combination that probably cost more than Anna's house on Europa had. It was the kind of thing she wore when she wanted to appear casual. "The prayer meeting," Anna said. "Good." And then, "not as good. Long. Very, very long." Tilly looked at her, the honesty getting her attention. "God, don't I know it? No one can blather on like a holy man with a trapped audience. Well, maybe a politician." Their food arrived, a Navy boy acting as waiter for the VIP civilians. Anna wondered what he thought of that. The UN military was all volunteer. He'd probably had a vision of what his military life would be like, and she doubted this was it. He carefully placed their food in front of them with the ease of long practice, gave them both a smile, and vanished back into the kitchen. Galley. They called it a galley on ships. Tilly picked half-heartedly at a farm-grown tomato and real mozzarella salad that Anna could have afforded on Europa by selling a kidney, and said, "Have you heard from Namono?" Anna nodded while she finished chewing a piece of fried tofu. "I got another video last night. Nami gets bigger in every one. She's getting used to the gravity, but the drugs make her cranky. We're thinking about taking her off of them early, even if it means more physical therapy." "Aw," Tilly said. It had a pro forma feel to it. Anna waited for her to change the subject. Robert hasn't checked in for a week now, Tilly said. She seemed resigned rather than sad.
You don't think he...
cheating? Tilly said with a laugh. I wish. That would at least be interesting. When he locks himself away in his office at 2 a.m., you know what I catch him looking at? Business reports, stock values, spreadsheets.
Robert is the least sexual creature I've ever met, at least until they invent a way to fuck money.
Tilly's casual obscenity had very quickly stopped bothering Anna. There was no anger in it. Like most of the things Tilly did, it struck her as another way to be noticed, to get people to pay attention to her.
How's the campaign coming? Anna said.
Esteban? Who knows? Robert's job is to be rich and have rich friends. I'm sure that part is coming along just fine. They ate in silence for a while. Then, without planning to, Anna said, I don't think I should have come.
Tilly nodded gravely, as though Anna had just quoted gospel at her.
None of us should have.
We pray, we get photographed, and we have meetings about interfaith cooperation, Anna continued. You know what we never talk about?
The ring?
No, I mean, yes. I mean, we talk about the ring all the time.
What is it? What's it for? Why did the protomolecule make it?
Tilly pushed her salad away and chewed another lozenge.
Then what?
What I thought we came here to do. To talk about what it means. Nearly 100 spiritual leaders and theologians on this ship, and none of us is talking about what the ring means.
For God?
Well, at least about God. Theological anthropology is a lot simpler when humans are the only ones with souls.
Tilly waved at the waiter and ordered a cocktail Anna had never heard of. The waiter seemed to know, though, and darted off to get it.
This seems like the kind of thing I'll need a drink for, she said. Go on.
But how does the protomolecule fit into that? Is it alive? It murders us, but it also builds amazing structures that are astonishingly advanced. Is it a tool used by someone more like us, only smarter? And if so, are they creatures with a sense of the divine? Do they have faith? What does that look like?
If they're even from the same God, Tilly said, using a short straw to mix her drink, then taking a sip.
Well, for some of us, there's only one, Anna replied. Then asked the waiter for tea. When he'd left again, she said, It calls into question the entire concept of grace. Well, not entirely, but it complicates it at the very least. The things that made the protomolecule are intelligent.
Does that mean they have souls?
They invade our solar system, kill us indiscriminately, steal our resources. All things we would consider sins if we were doing them. Does that mean they're fallen? Did Christ die for them too? Or are they intelligent but soulless, and everything the protomolecule's done is just like a virus doing what it's programmed for? A group of workers in civilian jumpsuits came into the dining area and sat down. They ordered food from the waiter and talked noisily among themselves. Anna let them distract her while her mind chewed over the worries she hadn't let herself articulate before today. And really, it's all pretty theoretical, even to me, she continued. Maybe none of that should matter to our faith at all, except that I have this feeling it will. That, to most people, it will matter.
Tilly was sipping her drink, which Anna knew from experience meant she was taking the conversation seriously.
Have you mentioned this to anyone? Tilly said, prompting her to continue.
Cortez acts like he's in charge, Anna replied. Her tea arrived and she blew on it for a while to cool it. I guess I should talk to him.
Cortez is a politician, Tilly said with a condescending smirk. Don't let his folksy Father Hank bullshit snow you.
He's here because as long as Esteban is in office, Cortez is a powerful man. This dog and pony show? This is all about votes.
I hate that, Anna said.
I believe you. You understand this all better than I do. But I hate that you're right. What a waste.
What would you ask Cortez for?
I'd like to organize some groups, have the conversation.
Do you need his permission? Tilly asked.
Anna thought of her last conversation with Nono and laughed. When she spoke, her voice sounded thoughtful, even to her.
No, she said. I guess I don't.
That night, Anna was awakened from a dream about taking Nami to Earth and watching her bones break as the gravity crushed her to a blaring alarm. It lasted only a few seconds, then stopped. A voice from her comm panel said, "All hands to action stations." Anna assumed this didn't mean her, as she had no idea what an action station was. There were no more alarms, and the voice from the comm panel didn't return with more dire pronouncements, but being startled out of her nightmare left her feeling wide awake and jumpy. She climbed out of her bunk, sent a short video message to Nono and Nami, and then put on some clothes. There was very little traffic in the corridor and lifts. The military people she did see looked tense, though to her relief not particularly frightened, just aware, vigilant. Having nowhere else to go, she wandered into the officer's mess and ordered a glass of milk. When it arrived, she was stunned to discover it was actual milk that had at some point come out of a cow. How much was the UN spending on this civilian dog and pony show? The only other people in the mess hall were a few military people with officers' uniforms and a small knot of the civilian contractors drinking coffee and slumping in their seats like workers in the middle of an all-nighter. A dozen metal tables were bolted to the floor with magnetic chairs at their sides. Wall displays scrolled information for the ship's officers, all of it gibberish to her. A row of cutouts opened into the galley, letting through plates of food and the sounds of industrial dishwashers and the smell of floor cleaner. It was like sitting too near the kitchen in a very, very clean restaurant. Anna drank her milk slowly, savoring the rich texture and ridiculous luxury of it. A bell chimed on someone's hand terminal, and two of the civilian workers got up and left. One stayed. A beautiful, but sad-faced woman who looked down at the terminal on the table with a vacant, thousand-yard stare.
"Excuse me, ma'am," said a voice behind her, almost making Anna jump out of her chair.
A young man in a naval officer's uniform moved into her field of view and gestured awkwardly at the chair next to her.
"Mind if I sit?"
Anna recovered enough to smile at him, and he took it as assent, stiffly folding himself into the seat. He was very tall for an Earther, with short, blonde hair and the thick shoulders and narrow waist all of the young officers seemed to have, regardless of gender. Anna reached across the table to shake his hand and said, "Anna Volovodov."
"Chris Williams," the young officer replied, giving her hand a short but firm shake.
"And yes, ma'am, I know who you are."
"You do?"
"Yes, ma'am. My people in Minnesota are Methodists, going back as far as we can trace them. When I saw you listed on the civilian roster, I made sure to remember the name."
Anna nodded and sipped her milk. If the boy had singled her out because she was a minister of his faith, then he wanted to talk to her as a member of the congregation. She mentally shifted gears to become Pastor Anna and said, "What can I do for you, Chris?"
"Love your accent, ma'am," Chris replied. He needed time to build up to whatever it was that he'd approached her about, so Anna gave it to him.
"I grew up in Moscow," she replied.
"Though after 2 years on Europa, I can almost do better now, Sasa."
Chris laughed, some of the tension draining out of his face.
"That's not bad, ma'am. but you get those guys going at full speed, I can't understand a word the skinnies say.
Anna chose to ignore the slur.
Please, no more ma'am. Makes me feel 100 years old. Anna, please, or Pastor Anna, if you have to.
All right, Chris said. Pastor Anna.
They sat together in companionable silence for a few moments while Anna watched Chris work up to whatever he needed to say.
You heard the alarm, right? He finally said. Bet it woke you up.
It's why I'm here, Anna replied.
Yeah, action stations. It's because of the dusters, I mean, Martians, you know.
Martians. Anna found herself wanting another glass of delicious milk, but thought it might distract Chris, so she didn't wave at the waiter.
We're in weapons range of their fleet now, he said. So we go on alert. We can't share sky with the dusters anymore without going on alert. Not since, you know, Ganymede.
Anna nodded and waited for him to continue.
And that ring, you know, it's already killed somebody. I mean, just a dumb-as-sand skinny slingshotter, but still, somebody.
Anna took his hand. He flinched a bit, but relaxed when she smiled at him.
That scares you.
Sure, of course, but that ain't it.
Anna waited, keeping her face carefully neutral.
The pretty civilian girl across the room got up suddenly, as though leaving. Her lips moved, talking to herself. Then she sat back down, put her arms on the table, and leaned her head on them. Someone else scared, waiting out the long watches of the night, all alone in a room full of people.
I mean, Chris said, breaking into her reverie, that ain't all of it anyway.
What else? Anna said.
The ring didn't put us on alert, he said. It's the Martians. Even with that thing out there, we're still thinking about shooting each other. That's pretty fucked up. Sorry, messed up.
It seems like we should be able to see past our human differences when we're confronted with something like this, doesn't it?
Chris nodded and squeezed her hand tighter, but said nothing.
Chris, would you like to pray with me?
He nodded and lowered his head, closing his eyes.
When she'd finished, he said, I know I'm not the only Methodist on the ship. Do you, you know, hold services?
I do now.
Sunday, at 10 a.m., in conference room 41, she said, making a mental note to ask someone if she could use conference room 41 on Sunday mornings.
I'll see if I can get the time off, Chris said with a smile.
Thank you, ma'am. Pastor Anna.
It was nice talking to you, Chris.
You just gave me a reason to be here.
When Chris left, Anna found herself very tired, ready to return to her bed. But the pretty girl across the room hadn't moved. Her head was still buried in her arms. Anna walked over to her and gently touched her on the shoulder. The girl's head jerked up, her eyes wild, almost panicked.
Hi, Anna said. I'm Anna. What's your name?
The girl stared up, as if the question were a difficult one. Anna sat down across from her.
I saw you sitting here, Anna said. It looked like you could use some company.
It's okay to be afraid. I understand.
The girl jerked to her feet like a malfunctioning machine. Her eyes were flat, and her head tilted a degree.
Anna felt suddenly afraid. It was like she'd gone to pet a dog and found herself with her hand on a lion. Something in the back of her head told her,
"This is a bad one. This one will hurt you."
"I'm sorry," Anna said, standing up with her hands half raised. "I didn't mean to disturb you."
"You don't know me," the girl replied. "You don't know anything."
Her hands were clenched into fists at her sides, the tendons in her neck quivering like plucked guitar strings.
"You're right," Anna said, still backing up and patting the air with her hands. "I apologize." Other people in the room were staring at them now, and Anna felt a surge of relief that she wasn't alone with the girl. The girl stared at her, trembling, for a few more seconds, then darted out of the room.
What the fuck was that all about?
Someone behind Anna said in a